a good body of knowledge which shows clearly that you can change the rate of radioactive decay, and you can do it with electrostatic scalar potential, for example.
Hmm. Okay, Greg.
Okay, thank you so much.
You betcha.
Bye-bye.
I'm Bill Jenkins with Tom Bearden, John C. Bedini, Steve Wirth, and Dr. Bob Beck. You know, the best place to spend the holidays this year, the people to cover the territory with tonight. Tom Bearden is in studio. Tom, so glad to have you with us. Usually, you're stuck away on that telephone in Huntsville, Alabama, so it's nice to hear what you really, really sound like and look like. John C. Bedini is here, the young man who has put together the device that will make free energy. Steve Wirth is here, the young man who puts together John Bedini's ideas. And then the two of them hassle back and forth and come up with all kinds of rather incredible things, wouldn't you say, John? Tom?
Yes.
And Dr. Bob Beck is here, who, he's been so much a part of this for so long that it's kind of fun to have you along, too. But I guess it's fun for you to see these things finally coming to fruition. You knew they always would.
About time.
About time. So it takes a lot of minds working together, and I think that's one of the reasons that you four want to be on a show like this tonight, to stimulate somebody's imagination out there. There are a lot of very brilliant men and women who are in physics and who are in science, and this matter of energy and scalar interferometry and all of the promise that it holds for mankind needs the combined genius of everyone who can jump in the fray and get with it. That's the way I feel. So, let's get back to our callers. We have Brian on the line. Brian, welcome aboard.
Thank you very much. I just can't wait until they're on again. So I have so many questions right now. I just keep it to a very, small amount.
Okay.
One of them, which is, in the Vietnam War, the F-16s that had no reason for being downed. I understand that some of the inference that some of the devices that the Russians were using downed these. Can anybody give an answer to that?
Well, I think yes.
Well, you're talking about the F-111.
F-111, yeah.
They had a very mysterious loss pattern. F-111s had some problems that were ordinary problems, of course, but the particular pattern I'm referring to, some eight or so of the F-111s were lost very quickly after they were deployed and very mysteriously. In other words, no mayday messages, no nothing. And then we didn't lose any more for some 4,000 missions. Well, when you have something that's that sharp an anomaly, it pays to look at it. What I think happened, I think that the Soviets wanted to get that hot new airplane, and they simply brought in a modification to a conventional, probably SA-2 radar, and they knocked down enough of them, which I am quite sure you can do with the scalar stuff. And after they got enough, they took the modification out and took it back to Russia with all the information they needed on the F-111. Now, we recovered one prisoner of war, one crew from the prisoner of war exchange. Now, they themselves, of course, don't think anything about a special kind of weapon or anything. They don't really know what knocked them down, but they did notice that all the systems, all the failure lights lit up at one time. Now, that airplane has like three redundant control systems. It's built to take extremely heavy punishment and still keep flying. And every system on the airplane was failing at once. That's the key. And that is a direct signature of this kind of thing. That's exactly what you would get if this was, in fact, what happened. In other words, that doesn't prove it, but it is certainly consistent with that approach. We do know the Soviets have the weapons.
Well, another question is, our government right now, it's the largest buildup in military probably in our history, as far as financially, and because of that, it makes you wonder where the expenditures are going. And what we have right now is, with the scare effect, is a possibility to not only stop what they're doing, but also to augment it in our systems. Is there anything going on in our government this time, or do you know of anything that could help us stop this and, of course, bring us up to speed?
Well, of course, I don't make any secret of the fact that for some period of years I've been trying to convince our government of this particular kinds of effects, of these kinds of effects. Certainly, Beck and other people have exerted enormous effort to try to call attention to the electromagnetics of certain situations to them. Beck has even gone so far as to actually demonstrate a device through a Faraday cage to them and to their complete disbelief, even though they saw it working. But there's a very long history of people trying to convince the government that there are some problems in this area, and we should be doing something. Now, that's having an effect, I guess is the way I'd have to say it. But at this time, I don't believe there's any real ongoing programs that are devoted towards really what I'm calling scalar electromagnetics. I hope there will be, because we need defenses.
Are they suffering from the NIH syndrome, not invented here?
Exactly.
Okay. There's an interesting aside on this, esteemed caller and Tom. About 2 years ago, the government sent out seven colonels. Have you heard the story? The Committee of Seven, to investigate technology that they felt might be essential to this country's staying at least caught up with the Soviets. And there was unanimous agreement that ELF, extreme low frequency effects, the entire committee pointed out that this was the top priority in the entire technological scene today. Further down this list, a friend of mine, Jack Halk, and his PK metal bending was on the list. When the colonels took this list back to General Marsh, he struck out any mention whatever of ELF. Now, this brings up an interesting question. Has some of this money gone into experimentation to catch up with the Soviets in this area? Did they consider it so important that they did not want any additional input or investigation? In other words, these little anomalies stand out like a sore thumb if you're a Pentagon watcher. And we really have no answer to why some of these areas have gone totally dark. Do you have any ideas on that, Tom?
Well, in my opinion, I don't think they believe that there are any extensions to electromagnetics. And the reason is very simple. Large programs are very bureaucratically handled. There's a, goodness gracious, there's 100 different agencies and committees and this and that that can harass, harangue, delay, destroy, cut, connive, change, or just completely stop a program. Anybody who's worked in the system knows, in our system today, it's almost impossible for anybody to have enough authority and ever be given enough funds with that authority to go ahead and build anything. They keep delaying, changing the idea of what they want to build because some other group comes in and says, no, that's not what we want. So I think what happens is most of those people who are party to making those kinds of decisions or make the effects, they really had their training a long time ago. What training they had was classical electromagnetics. They think everything is already well understood and in the book, and there's never going to be anything else new except what they got. And if you tell them that radar is the end of it, or is not the end of it, they're going to look at you and tell you they already well understand radar and there's nothing else you can do with it. So I think that problem, you can call that the not invented here syndrome or whatever, most of them don't know anything about quantum mechanics, or if they do, they go to the other extreme. If they're qualified in quantum mechanics, they tend to think that the textbook is already the end-all and be-all. So the real problem we have, also, we're not good at nonlinear stuff at all. The Russians have led the world for years in nonlinear mathematics. They've always been the best nonlinear mathematicians in the world. And I think the sum total of all of this means that the odds against us having anything like that are very long indeed. I don't know of anything we have in the way of scalar weapons or even any appreciable kind of effort to look at the field. And in fact, you know, I've been exerting an enormous effort in my own personal life to try to convince them of the fact that we have a grave danger and we have to do something about it. I will say this, they've quit laughing.
That's a good step.
They're taking it seriously, but they haven't yet moved to do anything about it. So I would characterize that as saying, the elephant is shuffling his feet, but he ain't got on the ball yet.
Does that help you, Brian?
Yes, I think one other question is that because of being able to down the 111s, that our particular aircraft can also have a device which could counteract that. Maybe Mr. Bearden could explain how that's done. I remember reading in some of his material that there was a device that could be built to counteract the scalar effect coming from the radar from the ground.
Another scalar device.
Well, it's like, you know, using a sword against a sword. You fight a scalar device with another scalar device. The weapons I'm most worried about right now are the cold explosion kinds of things, like happened at April the 9th 1984, 200 miles from downtown Tokyo in the ocean off Japan. I've discussed that before, and I don't want to dwell on it at length. I pointed out that there have been 77 other such plumes, or explosions, or whatever you want to call them, seen in the Soviet Arctic by our weather satellites since 1974. I do want to give one new piece of information, because I know this stuff is being recorded, and this one you need to know. If we have a cold explosion at a distance, if we extract an enormous amount of energy there, the energy emerges at the weapon, and you have to dump it. Now, that one in the ocean, arising from the ocean on April the 9th, was, depending on the various article you read, it was 150 to 200 miles in diameter, somewhere of that size, rather enormous. So there's an enormous amount of energy was suddenly and violently extracted from that area. So somebody somewhere has got to dump an awful amount of energy. I'm going to give you a reference because we have found the smoking gun. Okay, if you will check Aviation Week and Space Technology, September the 26th, 1983, page 31, and you got that on your tape now, I hope. You will find satellite photographs of the Soviet island of Bennett Island, about 350 miles north of the Soviet mainland, near the Arctic Circle. And you will find an exhaust coming out of the ground there that's about 150 miles long. Explosive puffs in it to show that it's explosively initiated. We've seen quite a few of them and taken pictures of them with our weather satellites. And that's a reference, and you can look at the picture yourself, and that's a good reference.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the work you're doing, and please keep it up. We need it, and I hope that the government will listen and still with the military.
Okay, Brian, thank
God
you.
Bless you.
Mm-hmm. KABC time now is 18 minutes past 11 o'clock. It's Open Mind. I'm Bill Jenkins. Sal is on the line. Hello, Sal. You're on.
Oh.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Sal from South Bay.
Okay, Sal.
I'd like to mention something relative to your work, John Bedini and Tom Bearden and Dr. Beck and so forth, Steve Wirth, and I'd like to ask about three or four main questions. But first I want to give my postulate to the Bill Jenkins Show being on nightly instead of only once a week.
Why do you want to do that to me for?
Well, because you deserve it. And we deserve you.
I think
great.
I think Mrs. Jenkins would really want to wring your neck.
I think you're important to have around, Bill.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Yeah.
Okay. A few years ago, I worked on helping a friend raise some money to help fund the research on a special project. And this friend of mine made a motor or a device that ran basically on air pressure, started it, and did the most unusual things that I could not even begin to justify some of the phenomena. But he was harassed by the local government.
Was that Carl Epker?
Carl who?
Epker.
Carl Martin?
Epker.
Epker.
Agatha,
yes, yes.
Yeah, you know about him.
Oh, yes. I spent quite a bit of time with the device.
Oh, great. I wanted that to happen. I could not even begin to describe it. I mean, I was there. I tried to help the man, and I'm very concerned about his work.
So. I tried to help him, too. Many's the test we ran, and I don't think I'd better comment any further.
Right. I don't want to comment either because it stupefied me and that. But I do hope that he can be supported and helped. If you know what I mean.
I know what you mean, and we all had great hopes for the device, and it was rather unusual. And there may have been some psychotronic involvement. His son apparently had quite a bit of PK going on around him. It was a most amazing thing. My buddy Ed Skilling got out there, and I tried to get astronaut Gordon Cooper involved. And, you've been out to his installation. He hired off-duty moonlighting cops and had incredible security. How long ago have you seen the device?
About 2 years ago.
Uh-huh. Well, I think you're a little bit more updated on it than I am. It was totally unpredictable.
What kind of device was it? What did it do?
Well, he built up a head of compressed air, and it was sort of an open turbine-like device, like a tea kettle with a spinning top. And I don't know.
It would exhaust. You would take 40 pounds of pressure to start it, and it would exhaust 120 pounds plus, and then the damn thing would accelerate, and you couldn't keep it on, otherwise the thing would go crazy.
Right, I know. I've been out there when the floors were shaking.
Yeah, and you had to screw it into the floor.
Right.
Otherwise it would float. And then the thing had very strong implications of antimatter, and it would physically affect matter in a transmutative way, in a positive way though, and it seemed to use the energy of the spin of the Earth, or sort of like a miniature solar system.
He had an absolutely amazing story that he laid on some of the investors. I believe what tripped him was in the Securities and Exchange domain.
Yeah. Well, just by bringing a battery near the damn thing, it would make it 3 or 4 times as powerful just by bringing it in close proximity. And it achieved ultrasonic fluid flow.
Well, one test that apparently turned out positive was the change in the modulus of elasticity of titanium and some other metals.
Right.
I remember the work that was done on that by one of the local aircraft plants, but I wasn't able to replicate with my own instruments some of the other claims.
I was interested in doing some biological experiments with the thing, but we never got that far.
Okay, well, listen, Sal, thank you very much.
I had a couple of questions.
Okay, quick questions.
Have you ever heard of Walter Russell?
Mm-hmm. Everybody's nodding their head, yes.
Everyone.
Have you ever done anything or tried to apply any of the work or know anybody that's involved with any of the work?
I don't know.
No.
No, because I think that's important. If you haven't found out about it, it's something you should know about. And then I read a book that indicated evidence that the government already was capable of transmitting energy to an exact location to the point of bringing a body riding in a car, burning it up while it was riding in the car without burning the clothing. Do you have any knowledge of this type of thing?
I never heard of that, Sal.
Alternative 3?
No, I've never heard the government do anything like that. Of course, I've heard of the phenomenon, as everybody has, of
spontaneous
combustion of bodies. But
have you read the book Alternative 3?
Are you familiar with Alternative 3?
Yes.
I've read it.
Leslie Watkins has been on the show a couple of times. He'll be the first to tell you that it was a work of fiction.
It was.
However, he says evidently he hit some very, very sore nerves along the way, even though it was a total work of fiction, and is continuing his investigation, and he's found out some quite incredible things working with the House of Lords.
Okay, two more quick questions.
No, Sal, I tell you what, there are too many lined up here to go. But I do appreciate you sharing all of that with us, okay? And we're going to go on to Don. Hello, Don. Welcome aboard.
Hi, Bill. Nice to talk to you this way.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Bearden, when you first described matter as a standing scalar wave, the first thing that came to my mind was the possibility of transporting matter in wave form. Were you implying that some such thing was possible?
Yes.
Uh-huh. But I take it you don't want to comment any further.
I'd rather not go any further. I will tell you how to visualize that standing scalar wave, though, to give you a better visualization. Imagine you have a cavity, and you have a wave traveling back and forth from wall to wall, reflecting off the wall. Now, if you take a plane in the middle and you suddenly stop the wave just as crossing that plane, stop it instantly, for a normal standing wave, you would have still, at that instance, you'd only have one ordinary electromagnetic wave with an electric field and a magnetic field in that plane. Now, that's the wave front I'm describing. Now, if you had a scalar wave there, you would have essentially two or more of those ordinary electromagnetic plane wave fronts, and the summation of the E fields would be zero, and the summation of the B fields would be zero.
Uh-huh.
But if you look at each one independently, it looks like a normal standing wave. You just have two or more of them that sort of self-cancel, and yet the self-cancelization is a zero-vector system. It is not a nothing. That is a standing scalar wave, and that's what mass is, and that's what gives you inertia.
Could you comment on the relationship between possible scalar standing wave and the quantum mechanical waves that, or at least our models from quantum mechanics, make up all physical particles?
I think it's very closely related to the de Broglie wave, which, the matter wave.
Uh-huh.
The fact that we regard, or interpret, I should say, excuse me, the de Broglie wave as being a probability wave, the Schrodinger wave for it being a probability wave. Probability automatically involves time.
Uh-huh.
As long as the thing has not collapsed in time, the wave function has not collapsed, then you have probabilities involved. You can speak of probabilities. And so I think what we're describing is very closely connected to the probabilities or the propagation of those probabilities. If you control this kind of wave, it would seem that you actually are beginning to control and change the actual probabilities assigned to the quantum mechanical states themselves. So it appears possible to do that with scalar waves.
So that in effect, quantum mechanics in the
you violate one of the primary assumptions.
The quantum mechanics.
Quantum mechanics. That is that the below the zero in the virtual state, that everything is really chaotic and
right.
random.
Uh-huh.
We're saying that when you put together deliberate vectors that make a zero vector, you have placed those active vectors down in the virtual state. You are now engineering the pre-physical reality, pre-collapse state directly, and so you can affect the Schrödinger wave in the individual states.
Which is what some theorists were positing all along.
Yes, Baum's, particularly David Baum.
Right. Another thing, last time you were on this show, I remember you spoke about violations of the second law of thermodynamics.
Yes.
And I didn't really follow them, but I was wondering if you could perhaps mention the implications for physical time travel.
Oh boy! Well, of course, the best way to look at physical time travel, I think, would be to look at a system that has many more dimensions than four. If you look at that, you can sort of go outside the system of the little time points you're looking at now, and you can come back in somewhere else by moving through a hyperdimension or a higher dimension. That's the easiest way to look at that. And so, of course, if you can operate in the higher dimensions, then, and you're using that kind of model, you theoretically could travel through what we call time. Time becomes itself many-dimensional, not just a single dimension as its model.
I notice you mentioned physical time travel. You realize that a time travel is being accomplished non-physically by the out-of-body travelers.
Well, that's why I put it that way. Yeah, that's why.
Well, you know, the funny thing is we're all traveling through time anyway, in physics anyway. We're already time travelers. And, in fact, we know the rate at which we travel through time can be changed. That's just relativity. The thing is that we have all kinds of arguments and interpretations about whether or not we can travel backwards. I believe, here I'd have to be very cautious in what I'm saying. I'd have to go back and check my notes. But I believe that at least some of the latest solutions to some of the general relativity things suggest that you can travel backwards in time.
But you're not presently pursuing any of those avenues,
well,
any implications of the scalar...
In my opinion, John Bedini's motor makes some negative time and makes some negative, what I would call negative energy. And I think we've got some very unusual effects going on there that's going to take all the physics we ever heard of and then some to explain. We just don't have a really good model to describe that yet.
Just one more thing I wanted. I know a lot of people must be waiting. I would like it if you could clarify a little bit more actually what a scalar wave is. I understand the canceling of two vectors so that you basically have a zero vector field, and then there is still...
I'll make it very simple. Imagine you have a steel plate about an inch thick between your fingers. You're pressing, but you've got very strong fingers. You're pressing very hard against both sides of that plate with all your fingers, but the force is all balanced to zero. Now, that's a zero vector system. The resultant is zero.
Right.
However, that's a very different plate from one that has no forces at all. It's under stress. Now imagine that I rhythmically vary the force with which I press on all my fingers. You know, I sinusoidally vary that, rhythmically increase and decrease the pressure with which I'm pressing on the plate.
Okay.
In other words, I squeeze and relax on the plate. Now, the plate still always has a resultant zero. It doesn't accelerate, doesn't wiggle, doesn't give you any detection. But there is a rhythmic stress wave that is now being created in that plate medium.
Right.
Now throw away the plate, leave the vacuum, and instead of my fingers, use electromagnetic forces, and you have just created a scalar wave in the vacuum.
Now, what relation does that have to virtual particles?
That, since it's in the zero, since you have made a deliberate zero system, and these are time-varying, you have folded in ordinary vectors inside a zero. That means they're inside the virtual state. Now, they are below the observable state. You have now placed specific determined vectors, not random stuff, down in the virtual state, and you can use it to engineer it. You can hit, for example, all of the frequencies in the nucleus. You can interfere with the virtual particle interactions going on, the binding the nucleus together and everything else. You can get at all of that now.
But this is, in effect, these are normal electromagnetic the waves that you're starting out with.
Each one individually is.
Uh-huh.
But the system of them put together with the resultant zero is a quite different breed of cat from a normal electromagnetic wave. They'll go through a Faraday cage, for example.
Uh-huh.
You know we're going to give a quiz at the end of the hour, Doc.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. You know, the best place, midnight, open mind. I'm Bill Jenkins, and we've got school in session here. And I hope you're paying attention. Tom Bearden is along with John Bedini, Steve Wirth, and Dr. Bob Beck. We're talking about free energy. We've gotten into a few other things, like scalar interferometry and vector forces and little particles that are not going anywhere but are under stress time. I couldn't pass the quiz, Tom, if we... Let's see how well Glenn is doing. Glenn, welcome aboard.
Hello, thank you very much. I feel like an absolute novice at this sort of thing, but I'm certainly interested in it.
Join the club.
Years ago, in the late 30s, I was experimenting with Tesla coils and such things, and I never realized the importance that Tesla himself had given to us in the way of science until listening to your program more or less recently.
Well, thank you.
But one of the things that came up in the 40s, because of friends that knew that I was interested in electrical things and electronics and that sort of thing, was a diagram, which I still have the copy of it, of a device for, quote, free energy that was developed by a man by the name of Hendershot.
Oh.
I hear a chuckle back there.
Chuckle Bob.
is there any connection with what you're doing?
Well, I spent a great deal of time with this, so did several colleagues of mine. In the opinion of some very competent observers, it actually worked. But no one else could start the device except Lester Jennings Hendershot himself. And I think he made fairly conclusive demonstrations that it would provide a couple of 100 watts of power. It had some remarkable qualities. It only worked when he was... Well, when he either started it or was in the room with it.
Huh.
And this is very, very far out, but a number of people felt that perhaps it was a psychotronic type phenomena similar to poltergeist energy.
Uh-huh.
Now, that's further out than I like to normally go, but a number of those devices were built that were absolutely, totally identical to the one that he made. There were little basket weave coils, and there was a telephone magnet, and I've had several of these, one or two of which were actually working. He died down in Cyprus a number of years ago, but some of the devices are still kicking around.
Uh-huh.
And I spent dozens of hours analyzing every inductance, impedance, LC factors, resonant node. I could do nothing with it, and I have quite a few gray hairs to prove it. But the Lester Jennings Hendershot device was one of those apocryphal, let's say, parts of history, like the T. Henry Moray device. And I could tell you stories about that one all night long, but I won't.
Uh-huh. Well, the thing that interested me about it at the time when it was proposed to me was because I had been brought up by a family of Hendershot.
Well.
But it has apparently no connection with Lester. I have since gotten into ham radio and electronics of various kinds, and I'm doing service work and repair work on commercial equipment, home equipment of various kinds. But I'm interested in delving a little deeper into this thing, and I understand there were some writings that were available from Tesla?
Well, there's more than writings. I mean, more than just Tesla. John has some papers available. Tom does. In fact, John, I think you have a new videotape, do you?
Yeah, we made a tape. It's not very good quality, but it's... I apologize for that. But it does show you the G-field type generator running. There's some very strange things. Let's say there's some very strange things going on. There's like when you phase this type generator correctly, it'll pop quartz lights, just explode them.
Hmm.
It'll also run 1/5 horsepower motors that you can't stop and nobody can figure out where the power is. With halfway rectifiers, it'll put into a battery bank... Uh, 16 amps at 100 volts across the rectifier, and according to everything that I've been taught, you know, it's volts times amps is watts.
Yeah.
So that sounds like some material you could get into.
Yeah, you can. That could prove some points to you about some of these autophase systems, or what they call nonlinear systems. Its best performance to date has been with the quartz heaters and the battery banks. In other words, for some reason, the battery banks offer some form of impedance to it, and they just... you can regulate it, by the way, now, and you can save the battery from boiling away.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Well, now, is the to understand that the higher the impedance, the higher the wattage gets up?
That's right. That's the if you have, say, a 4-ohm load, and you put so many volts across that 4-ohm load, let's say you put 10 volts across that 4-ohm load, okay?
Yeah.
Well, that's going to be so many watts. What I've noticed with this generator is that you can take that 25-watt resistor, and the resistor stays absolutely dead cold.
Uh-huh.
Okay?